relevant portions of the brain that she claims to be crucial for language. This does raise an interesting question for the relationship between the brain and language, though. If language is indeed as old as it seems to be, then did Homo erectus or Homo neanderthalensis also have BA44? That is, can language exist without the modern brain area known as BA44? No one knows. But then if there is no idea whether this area is found in other species of Homo, no one has any idea which parts of the brain supported syntax in Erectus or Neanderthalensis. This means that it is not known whether BA44 is necessary for syntax. One suspects that, because the human brain is flexible, different parts of it will be exploited at different times in the evolutionary history of our genus subsequent to Erectus. The portion of the brain used by modern humans may be simply the neurobiology that contemporary Homo brains avail themselves of. Earlier species may well have used different brain structures for syntax. Another issue with Frederici's analysis of BA44 has to do with the fact that it was inspired by very famous experiments with cotton-top tamarin monkeys that were conducted by Tecumseh Fitch and Mark Hauser in the earlier part of the 2000s. The experiments are problematic for at least two reasons. The first reason is that they may be unreliable. I watched an unsuccessful attempt to run a version of these experiments by Fitch among the piranhas in 2007 when he was my guest in the Amazon. But if these experiments failed with human subjects, it is possible that they also did not run as well as believed among tamarins. Perhaps they are not sensitive to syntax in the way claimed for them. The most serious problem with these experiments, however, is that the science behind them is flawed. In the Psychonomic Bulletin and Review, this response was published by Pierre Perrochet and Arnold Ray. In a recent science paper, Fitch and Hauser claim to have demonstrated that cotton-top tamarins fail to learn an artificial language produced by a phrase structure grammar, generating center-embedded sentences, while adult humans easily learn such a language. We report an experiment replicating the results of FNH in humans, but also showing that participants learn the language without exploiting, in any way, the center-embedded structure. When the procedure was modified to make the processing of this structure mandatory, participants no longer showed evidence of learning. We propose a simple interpretation for the difference in performance observed in FNH's task between humans and tamarins, and argue that, beyond the specific drawbacks inherent to FNH's study, researching the source of the inability of non-human primates to master language within a framework built around the Chomsky's hierarchy of grammars is a conceptual dead end. Adding to the skepticism about Fitch and Hauser's results, Professor Mark Liberman offered his own response on the widely read blog Language Log, concluding that Fitch and Hauser's findings were in all likelihood about memory, not grammar per se. But if that is correct, then these studies have no bearing on Frederici's claims, offering no support for either her methodology or her conclusions. What this skepticism shows is that the popular idea that human brains are hardwired for language is not confirmed by science, even though it is often claimed. Nevertheless, there has always been a temptation, since brain studies began in earnest, to associate the structure of the brain, its lobes, layers, sections, and other gross anatomical features, with different kinds of intelligence or distinct tasks. The outmoded science of phrenology, or localization, was a consequence of trying to associate physical features of our skull with the cognitive, emotional, and moral properties of the brain encased within it. This is another error of overusing the Galilean metaphor of the universe or the brain as a clock. The human brain must be able to follow conversations, use words appropriately, remember and execute pronunciations, decode pronunciations it hears from others, keep track of the stories in the conversations, remember who is being talked about, and follow topics through long discussions. And this is only a small list of the ways in which language requires memory. No memory, no language. No memory, no culture. But language requires a special set of memories, not just any memory. The different varieties of memory that underlie language are sensory memory, short-term or working memory, and long-term memory. Sensory memory holds information from the five senses in the brain for very short periods of time. It is able to capture visual, oral, or tactile information in less than a second. In this way, sensory memory enables one to look at a painting, say, or hear a song, or feel someone's touch, and remember what the experience looked like, sounded like, or felt like. This type of memory is vital to learning from new experiences, and it is particularly important for language learning. Remembering how new words sound, long enough to repeat them, and build them into long-term memory. Sensory information is like a reflex, and just seems to happen, but it is not sufficient alone to support language. It degrades very quickly. If one examines a sequence of numbers, they might be remembered, though sensory memory is limited to a maximum of about 12 items, but in all probability not long enough to walk across the room and write them all down. There are three varieties of sensory memory: echoic, for sounds, iconic, for vision, and haptic, for tactile sensations. Another kind of memory, short-term or working memory, is also crucial in the use of language. At an MIT conference on 11 September 1956, remembered for a series of brilliant lectures that some refer to now as the Cognitive Revolution, psychologist George A. Miller, then of Bell Laboratories, later of Princeton, presented a paper entitled The Magical Number 7, Plus or Minus 2. Miller's research concluded that, without practice, people can remember up to 9, usually more like 5, items at a time for roughly a minute. Some have come to disagree with Miller and believe working memory is actually lower than this, around 4 items at a time. Miller discovered, however, that if items are chunked, then people are able to remember larger numbers of items. This turned out to be a great result for science, but also for Bell Labs. Bell discovered that a person might have difficulty remembering the number 58317-40263, but that they could easily remember it if it were chunked, as in 58317-40263. It further turns out that working memory is biased towards sound-based memories, which means not only that it is important for remembering and decoding utterances, but also that it seems to have partially evolved for that very purpose, language once again helping to shape human evolution. The next form of memory is long-term. Most people remember a great deal of their childhoods. The memories may be partially inaccurate in some ways, altered over time by different conversations about them, but something of those early experiences is there for the entirety of people's lives. Long-term memory can recall vast amounts of data for a nearly unlimited period of time within the confines of human lifespans. Long-term memory is divided into declarative memory and procedural memory. Procedural memory is implicit memory of processes involving motor skills. When trying to remember a password, your declarative memory might fail you in the sense that you cannot recall the names of all the symbols you have chosen for your password, but your procedural memory can come to the rescue if you will simply set yourself down at the keyboard and type the password. In a sense, your fingers remember a code that your conscious memory has forgotten. Or someone might be trying to teach another person how to play a riff on the guitar and forget the notes. They can still teach the riff, however, by slowly playing it for the learner. But be careful not to play too slowly. Procedural memory seems to prefer to keep things at tempo. Procedural memory is vital for pronunciation or for gestures in sign languages, providing much quicker use and access to words and signs than declarative memory, just as one's fingers might better remember their computer password. Without procedural memory, language and much of culture would be impossible. Obviously, any animal that can do routines quickly also has a form of procedural memory. It is not unique to humans. Declarative memory is subdivided into semantic memory and episodic memory. Semantic memory is associated with facts independent of any context, such as, a bachelor is an unmarried male. It is crucial for linguistic meanings. And it is also vital for other context-free long-term memories, such as 9/11 was a horrible day. Episodic memories, on the other hand, are long-term memories associated with a specific context and, therefore, tend to be more personal. You might use this memory to recall, "That's where we had our first water pistol fight," or, "That's the Mexicali bar where I had my first tequila." Working memory takes place as exchanges between neurons in the frontal cortex. But long-term memories are widely distributed in the brain and seem to be processed initially by the hippocampus, which consolidates memory for long-term storage elsewhere. Thus, we must have brains that can support the three basic types of memory humans use so frequently and depend on to survive and to speak. Several cultural traditions have attributed various functions to specific bodily organs and their parts, such as emotions being centered in the heart, thoughts being processed in certain parts of the brain, and language being rooted in others. But culture can only get things right as its scientific methods, output, and understanding evolve over time. It is now almost universally accepted that the heart has nothing to do with emotions. It is a blood pump, nothing more. And it is likewise, though perhaps less widely, now known that, although the brain is fundamental to the processing of all of our cognitive functions, it is not the sole locus of those functions. The resources of our entire body are marshaled in thinking, just as they are in communicating. If you doubt this, imagine how illness or a hangover can affect your ability to think clearly. And the brain's thoughts largely come from the totality of our personal experiences as they store and embellish them. These are also known as apperceptions, the experiences that make people who they are. But let's call the question, how is it that the brain enables people to speak? And what prevents other animals from having language? The French philosopher René Descartes was the morning star of the Renaissance, a touchstone in the culture and history of the Western world. He was a pioneer who brought innovative, original thinking back into fashion after more than five centuries of talking about people instead of ideas. Before Descartes and a few others, there yawned back into the shadows the nearly 1,000-year-long oppressive Dark Ages, during which reasoning was an act of power. Because of this, ad hominem arguments for one's views, arguments based on some person's reputation rather than the ideas at the heart of their arguments, were the standard. Descartes' work on the mind revolves around his popular thesis of dualism, the proposal that the mind is our soul and is non-material, be it spiritual, platonic, or merely mental, while the body is material. According to Descartes, these are two irreconcilable substances, He suggested that the soul and the body were connected, however, through the pineal gland. For whatever reason, perhaps it is due to religious traditions that oppose the soul and body, dualism has been an influential thesis for more than 400 years. Descartes' work was the basis for much of Noam Chomsky's theory of the mind and language and their relationship, as Chomsky explains in his book, Cartesian Linguistics. Chomsky seems to support Descartes' claim that while the body is a machine, the mind is not obviously physical. Dualism places evolutionary accounts of human thinking at a disadvantage for the simple reason that something non-physical could not have evolved. Therefore, if we accept this dualism, we reject the idea that the mind evolved by natural selection. In public talks and written works, one often sees cited the erstwhile theist Alfred Wallace, co-discoverer of natural selection, as support for the dualistic view of the mind, as somehow a different substance from the body. Wallace did indeed believe that the mind, as a Cartesian non-material entity, could not have evolved. It would seem, however, that the best way forward is not the way of dualism, but the simpler idea that one should first try to explain things in natural, physical terms before proposing new entities or substances. This would especially apply if one believed that there was no physical basis for thought. To argue for such an idea, one would need to begin with the mundane evidence of the fossils, of DNA, of theories of language and culture, as well as comparative primatology, before proposing non-physical explanations for language, human intelligence, or human minds more generally. Theories of the human brain and mind have been around for millennia. Scholars often are careful to distinguish these two terms, brain versus mind, but this separation is ultimately inspired by both dualism and religion. In this conception, the word mind refers to the brain activities and properties people are currently unable to explain in physiological terms. But this position assumes that science could, in principle, eventually provide neurophysiological explanations for the properties people today refer to as the mental. Earlier, it was mentioned that paleoneurologists practice a reverse form of phrenology when they study endocasts of fossil skulls, the inside of the skull rather than the outside. Some endocasts are naturally formed, as the skulls of dead creatures fill with material that fossilizes and is left with physical impressions from the inside of the skull. Other endocasts are made by the paleoneurologist. Researcher Ralph Holloway has summarized how this is done. The procedure is to first fill the cranium with layers of latex. Next, when the latex is roughly 1 to 2 millimeters thick, place the skull in an oven for 3 to 4 hours to cure it, after which you force the latex out of the brain cavity. Holloway says that this can be done by collapsing the latex, using baby powder to prevent it sticking to the fossil, and then carefully extruding it from the fossil through the foramen magnum. After the latex is removed, it will revert immediately to the form it had in the skull. There is nothing wrong with the reverse phrenology of endocast reading, so long as the paleoneurologist remembers that the brain regions identified on the endocast are only suggestions for what might have been, not unambiguous evidence for, certainly not proofs for or against, different cognitive or linguistic abilities. Endocasts are less informative than one might like because they say so little about the fossil's cytoarchitecture, about white versus gray matter distribution, and about relative ratios of cell types, such as glial cells to neurons and other aspects of brain anatomy, such as neuronal density, that are never revealed on the underside or outside of skulls. Another problem is that the brain is in some ways more like a blob and less like a heart, with its separate chambers. In the brain, different tasks are performed by spontaneous or pre-existing connections that draw first on the parts of the blob that are most conducive to the task, and subsequently on more and more firepower until the task is done. Many of these initially spontaneous connections become more routine after frequent exposure to similar tasks, indicating that learning has occurred. There is a system to the activations, but that system is less anatomical than electrochemical. It is more fluid and dynamic than static and hardwired. In brain organization, chemicals rule. Hormones generated by our emotions, thinking processes, diet, and the overall state of our entire organism control our brain. This is why many neuroscientists have embraced the theory that the brain is embodied, built into an anatomical, chemical, electrical, and physically constrained system, namely, our bodies. To such researchers, it is not so much that the brain thinks as that the entire individual does. Thus, the brain is a physical organ, a constituent of the body, as all other organs are. This embodiment, along with the role of culture in our thinking, means that the brain is an organ physically integrated into the world through a body, and not a computer. The picture of the brain that is emerging here, then, is of a cognitively non-modular organ with no congenitally specialized tissue for language, or cooking, or guitar playing. This is in direct contrast to the innately specialized areas that exist for physical abilities, but not for cultural or conceptual ones. If it is correct that language is a cultural artifact, the absence of a specialized brain area for it is predicted. If this idea is wrong, though, then language is more like vision, and there should be evidence that language is innately linked to a particular location of the brain, specialized for language. Further evidence for this general-purpose image of the homo brain comes from disorders of language and speech. It turns out, very surprisingly, given claims frequently found in the literature, that there are no heritable language-specific disorders, supporting the non-compartmentalized theory of the brain. 7. When the brain goes wrong. Language disorders do not occur in isolation. Aphasic disturbances rarely occur in the absence of memory impairment or attention or executive problems. Yves Turgeon and Joël Marchois. One way to test the prediction that language is innate and hardwired in certain portions of the brain is to examine the nature of language disorders. If language is an encapsulated innate module of the brain, then it should be possible to observe language problems that are linked exclusively to particular language-only parts of the brain. If, on the other hand, language is a culturally acquired invention, there should be no specifically linguistic disorders. While the latter idea, that there are no heritable language-only disorders, seems correct, there is a list of respected researchers that claim otherwise. To help determine what the truth really is, the evidence from so-called language-specific disorders needs to be considered here. The place to begin is the disorder with the challenging label, Specific Language Impairment, SLI. SLI supposedly affects linguistic functions exclusively. No other part of the brain or other aspects of our cognitive functioning is purported to be affected in this syndrome, according to some researchers. Some assert that SLI shows that the brain is genetically hardwired for specific linguistic knowledge, because this eponymous deficit affects only linguistic knowledge. In fact, this label is misleading because it suggests that something has been found that in fact has never been discovered, namely, a disorder that affects only our linguistic abilities. To the contrary, this disorder always seems to affect non-linguistic aspects of our cognition as well. Therefore, whatever the nature of such impairments are, they are not language-specific. Even if SLI existed as described, this would not indicate that there is a portion of the brain hardwired by the genes for language. That is because acquired skills and knowledge can also be affected in addition to language. Factors such as amnesia, blunt force trauma, alcohol, and bullets are some of the causes of language disorders. Therefore, the existence of a disorder implies on the surface nothing about whether the ability affected by the disorder is innate or learned. On the other hand, the model that takes language as an innate capacity of humans does predict highly specific language deficits. The view that language is instead an invention, a cultural artifact, predicts that language deficits are no more likely than bread-baking deficits. And it turns out that the thesis that the brain is a general-purpose device predicts exactly what is found. Deficits that affect language are multifaceted. The language effects themselves are never more than a portion of the overall syndrome. Therefore, a more detailed look at a few so-called language deficits is called for. Michael T. Ullman and Elizabeth I. Pierpont, neuroscientists at Georgetown University, define SLI along the following lines. Specific language impairment, SLI, is generally defined as a developmental disorder of language in the absence of frank neurological damage, severe environmental deprivation, or mental retardation. Other terms have also been used, such as developmental dysphagia, language impairment, language learning disability, developmental language disorder, delayed speech, and deviant language. There are researchers who consider SLI a dysfunction or deficit of the language module of the brain, the mental capacity exclusively responsible for language. Several explanations of SLI have therefore been phrased in terms of syntax, sentence structure, or phonology, sound structure, or morphology, word structure. These are well-defined submodules or subcomponents of language in some theories. One prediction of SLI might be that a child with this disorder is unable to construct the right types of syntactic tree diagrams mentally, however such structures are implemented in the brain. A linguist might predict that someone could be born without the ability to perform the syntactic operation merge. An alternative analysis of this ailment is proposed by Ullman and Pierpont, namely that what is referred to as SLI should instead be understood in terms of a procedural deficit. This counterproposal claims that a significant proportion of individuals with SLI suffer from abnormalities of this brain network, leading to impairments of the linguistic and non-linguistic functions that depend on it. Moreover, they conclude that Broca's area, the region of the brain associated with not only grammar, but most procedural motor skills and activities, is implicated, along with procedural memory, our ability to remember how to do things in sequences, meaning that although one sees effects in language, the root of SLI is not linguistic per se, but something of a higher order, the memory and procedural learning that underlie many human activities, of which language is but one. In the words of Ullman and Pierpont, the different structures of the procedural system provide distinct and complementary computational and functional contributions. For example, the basal ganglia are particularly important for learning new procedures, but may be less so for the normal processing of already learned procedures. So, abnormalities of different structures in the system should lead to different types of impairments of procedural memory. Although there are many studies, such as the one mentioned here, against the existence of SLI, it would be premature to consider the matter settled. But, as of this writing, it can be concluded that SLI offers no support for the idea that grammar or language is innate, as opposed to the idea that each is a cultural tool that is malleable, changes over time, and is learned afresh by every child as they engage in natural conversations and interactions with other members of their community. Nevertheless, in a 2014 article in the journal Cell, Steven Pinker and Heather Vanderlelly take a very different view of SLI. They claim that SLI is highly heritable and very specific to language. Heritability of SLI is an interesting observation. It would mean that the deficit comes from some hardwired, genetically preordained ability that can become a disability of malfunctioning genes. But other work has argued that the heritability of SLI may be little more than a gleam in the eye of the beholder. How you define a disease can determine what you find. One study of this kind concludes that heritability estimates for specific language impairment, SLI, have been inconsistent. A recent report from the Twins Early Development Study found negligible genetic influence. Moreover, what is inherited is wider than merely a language disorder. Other aspects of cognition are affected. This means that the genetic problem is not so much linguistic as a more general problem of brain processing. The evidence that SLI is a more general malady is just what would be predicted if there were no brain module for language, as the evolutionary record seems to suggest. As others put it, the choice of a particular assessment method, the selection of evaluation tools, as well as the interpretation of results, are highly dependent not only on the clinician's own conception of language, but also on the reference to an assessment model. Language disorders do not occur in isolation. Aphasic disturbances rarely occur in the absence of memory impairment or attention or executive problems. Language production and comprehension are complex cognitive skills which should not be considered in isolation in assessment procedures. Another problem that affects human language is a complete or partial inability to speak, referred to as aphasia, from the Greek a, without, and phasis, speech. Aphasia is caused by brain damage and regularly affects about 1 million people in the USA alone. Its primary cause seems to be a problem with blood flow to the brain, which is often the byproduct of a stroke. People with aphasia manifest one of a few different kinds of disorders. They can have problems with understanding what they hear, auditory comprehension, or difficulties communicating intelligibly, find reading and writing challenging, or struggle to express themselves verbally. Aphasia is most commonly a result of extensive damage to the left hemisphere, the side of the brain long known to be implicated heavily in language and other tasks. Since the left hemisphere is, however, not exclusively dedicated to language, this means that aphasia will never affect language only. Some approaches to aphasia in the past have seen it largely in anatomical terms, localizing it to what were considered once to be language-specific regions of the brain, such as Broca's and Wernicke's areas. And indeed, it is correct that there are specific kinds of aphasia associated with these general regions in the brain, as we have seen. Broca's aphasia, also known as motor aphasia or expressive aphasia, is characterized by relatively solid comprehension, but difficulty in speaking. Significantly, however, people with this form of aphasia also usually have paralysis, or at least weakness, in their right appendages, the arm, the leg, or both. Another well-known type of aphasia is Wernicke's aphasia, also known as receptive aphasia or sensory aphasia. In this form of aphasia, the subject is able to speak fluently, but unable to understand what is said to them. Moreover, their fluent speech is often chock-a-block with abnormalities, such as nonsense words that, while fitting the sound patterns of their native language, mean nothing and are otherwise not words at all. There are other forms of aphasia. This is, of course, unsurprising, since there are many aspects of language and many ways in which one might imagine it breaking down, especially if it is an artifact. In an article in the journal Aphasiology, Edward Gibson and his co-authors offer an instructive analysis of strategies for overcoming aphasic language comprehension problems developed by the aphasics themselves. What this team discovered is reminiscent of a G1 language. The aphasics in Gibson's study use contextual clues more extensively than non-aphasic subjects in order to interpret what is spoken to them. Homo erectus, in my model at least, would have produced utterances that were highly ambiguous or vague or both, depending on his or her interlocutor's ability to link speech to context for an interpretation more or less in the ballpark of what was intended. Homo erectus might, therefore, have used a strategy similar to aphasics for interpreting sentences. But that is what all people do. All utterances are interpreted, at least in part, based on knowledge of culture, the context, and the world. A discussion of language and the brain cannot end, however, before discussing another set of cognitive disorders, collectively known as autistic spectrum disorder. ASD reveals the importance of the society to language and the role of conversation as the apex of linguistic experience. Therefore, we must take special care in our discussion here. Richard Griffin and Daniel C. Dennett of Tufts University get at what seems to be the general thread running through many autism cases, namely that sufferers of autism share a pervasive bias to attend toward local rather than global features. This is sometimes referred to as weak central coherence, and means that sufferers struggle to grasp an entire social situation in context. The first two people I can remember with ASD were friends of mine. One was a fellow redhead, brother of a grammar school buddy. The other was a second cousin. In the case of my friend's brother, I did not even know of his existence until I visited my friend's house and learned that he had a brother visiting from another school somewhere. He didn't seem old enough to be in college, so I couldn't really understand why he wouldn't be in school with us. As we were introduced, though, he was quiet and looked around erratically. I was about 12 years old. He would have been perhaps 14. He wouldn't answer me, so I asked my friend, "Hey, what's wrong with your brother? Is he simple-minded?" My friend laughed. "No, he is not simple. He's pretty smart. Want to see?" I immediately replied, "Yes," though I was curious as to how my friend's brother would demonstrate his intelligence. This was answered quickly. My friend took the annual calendar off of his bedroom wall and handed it to me. He suggested that I pick any month and ask his brother what day of the week any date was. "What for?" "Just ask him, you'll see." So I thumbed through the calendar and picked a date earlier in the year. I think I asked, "What is the day of January 21st, 1963? He immediately and correctly responded with the day of the week. I ran through about 20 dates all over the year. Then I asked him about other years. He never hesitated. He never erred. I was ready to acknowledge his intelligence as far exceeding my own. My friend's brother was giggling, and giggled harder with every new date I asked him. In my 12 years, I had never heard of anything like that, much less witnessed such an example. "How the hell's he do that?" I demanded. "No idea," replied my friend. He told his brother, "Great job." I learned through this, though only later in life as I continued to think about what I had seen, that my friend's brother had at least two unusual characteristics, a seemingly deficient social ability, and a brain that could do some things better than I had ever seen done. Yet the social difficulty meant that he struggled to carry on a conversation. My friend was particularly solicitous of his brother. "He's done now," he announced. "Let's go." And so we did. My next encounter with what, in retrospect, was most probably also ASD, was with a second cousin I used to see daily at school. Other children teased him mercilessly. Once he yelled back at a tormentor with a nearly inarticulate, "No, goddammit!" and started hitting them with both hands. They initially started laughing. Then they realized he was really hurting them, so they apologized. My cousin stopped and walked away without another word. Neither I nor any of my friends at that time had a concept of neurodiversity. Anyone who didn't behave exactly as we expected, we considered handicapped. So, if I thought about my cousin, I felt pity for him. Then one day, in an assembly of the entire junior high school that we both attended, the principal began to announce awards. Eventually, he worked his way down the list to the two main awards of the year, scholarship and citizenship. When he said, "For the first time, both awards go to the same person," I wasn't surprised. I expected them to go to a good friend of mine. But no. The name called, to my amazement, was my cousin's. For the first time in my life, I realized that I was no judge of character. I teared up because I knew all the grief that my cousin put up with every day at school, and he won citizenship. Conversations were just excruciatingly difficult for him. When he did talk, he became emotional and inarticulate very quickly. But he went to school. He ate alone. And then he impressed everyone with his intelligence and kindness. There is, in fact, no single disease or etiology that corresponds to what the general public calls autism, only a set of symptoms that professionals have decided to group under the general label of autistic spectrum disorder. Not everyone with this disorder behaves the same, as in the two different examples from my childhood. The symptoms of ASD include the following, broken into a couple of distinct areas. Communication. Autism sufferers struggle with communication and interactions with other people. People with this condition abnormally engage in routines or repetitive behaviors, sometimes called stereotyped behaviors. Autistics do not respond to their names by 12 months of age and cannot easily explain what they want. Generally, those with autism do not follow directions. Sometimes they seem to hear, but not at other times. In general, those with autism neither point nor wave bye-bye. Social behavior. People with autism generally don't smile when smiled at, make poor eye contact, and appear to prefer to play alone. When fetching items or picking things up, they generally bring things for themselves only. Autism sufferers are independent for their age, yet give the impression of being in their own world. They act as if they tune people out and are uninterested in other children, failing to point out interesting objects by 14 months of age, a normal time frame for that development, and don't like to play peekaboo. Sufferers do not try to attract their parents' attention. Stereotyped behavior. Affected individuals get stuck, doing the same things over and over, and can't move on, showing unusual attachment to toys, objects, or routines, always holding a string or having to put on socks before pants, and spend a lot of time lining things up or putting things in a certain order. They repeat words or phrases, sometimes called echolalia. Other behavior. Children with autism may not play make-believe or pretend by 18 months of age. They have odd movement patterns and do not know how to play with toys appropriately, in spite of being attached strongly to them. Autism sufferers do some things early compared to other children, such as walking on their toes, but do not like to climb on things such as stairs. These children don't imitate silly faces and seem to stare at nothing or wander around with no purpose. They throw intense or violent tantrums. Autistics may be overly active, uncooperative, or resistant, and are overly sensitive to noise. The affected also prefer not to be swung or bounced on their parents' knee, etc. A variety of causes have been proposed for ASD, including bad socialization, bad parenting, bad genes, neurological development problems, excess testosterone, and mind blindness, the purported lack of a theory of mind, that is, a failure to recognize that others have a mind like the subject does. Research often produces messy results, though researchers often prefer elegant results. The idea that ASD is caused by mind blindness is a neat generalization, but just doesn't seem to get an account of the spectrum of autistic disorders. None of these do. Rather, there is a sense in which they each play a role to a greater or lesser degree. As Dr. Helen Tager Flusberg, one of the world's leading autism researchers, puts it, "Autism is a complex and heterogeneous disorder that should not be reduced to a single underlying cognitive impairment." My own peculiar perspective on ASD as an outsider to the research and lacking the clinical expertise of real professionals is that it is a breakdown of the ability to build components of the dark matter of the mind, structured cultural knowledge that underlies the development of the psychology of each individual as a cultural being. In other words, I agree with the general assessment in the literature that ASD is at root a social problem. But it is certainly a very unusual type of social problem, one which affects the ability to properly understand the intentions and thinking of others, or to structure understanding about others from a background of cultural knowledge. The symptoms of ASD are consistent with the idea that sufferers of the disorder are unable to incorporate other people's prioritization or ranking of values, perspectives, intentions, social roles, and knowledge structures into the construction of their psyche. Thus, they struggle to grasp the social implications of their apperceptions. But they show even more abnormalities, including certain bodily experiences. One possibility is that some of the physical aversions and preferences feed similar experiences in their minds, and ASD sufferers intensely dislike intrusions into their mental lives. Things such as sounds, touching, play, disorder that they cannot fix, and phatic language distress sufferers. But, of course, these are crucial to constructing the articulated unconscious that is vital for one's appreciation for and place in the culture of our community. Phatic language difficulties are particularly revealing and include things like leave-takings, goodbye, adios, hasta la vista, baby, and bye-bye, greetings, what's up, dude, what is it, hello, gratitude expressions, thanks. Oh, wow. I can never repay you. And so on. Phatic language has long been analyzed by linguists and anthropologists as a form of grooming, that is, a recognition of the other as a person you value, however superficially. Interestingly, although English, which has phatic language, lacks grooming as a regular cultural ritual across most of its communities, Piraha, an Amazonian language, has daily grooming, in which men and women sit in lines and look for lice in each other's hair, or simply stroke each other's hair. Yet it lacks phatic vocabulary. In other words, perhaps all cultures develop mechanisms, linguistic or otherwise, to demonstrate belonging and care to one another as members of the same community. ASD sufferers often seem to lack this capacity of mutual grooming behaviors that establish that two or more individuals belong together and accept one another. Put in other ways, the ASD sufferer is often unable to build a theory either of their enveloping culture or of the intentions of those they interact with. Equally significantly, they are unable to develop a full range of cultural knowledge, values, and appreciation of social roles in order to construct a social identity. The isolation and dysfunctionality of ASD sufferers might be argued to arise from, in part, their inability to converse normally with others, itself resulting from a social inability to feel mutual belonging and share mutual ideas. To converse normally requires and helps to construct a reasonable command of the grammar of the language in which the conversation is taking place, an understanding of the context of the conversation, the purpose of the conversation, the mental state of the interlocutors, cultural background knowledge, and general world knowledge. These different abilities and forms of knowledge all boil down to recognizing culture and working to belong to one. These seem to be the major ethno-linguistic difficulties faced by people with ASD. Not only is conversation the apex of language, but engaging in conversations has been shown by many researchers to build cultural connections and knowledge while actually constructing the very grammar that is necessary for the conversation. In other words, as we have seen many times, language is synergistic, two or more components of or applications of language mutually enabling one another. In this sense, the very existence of ASD underscores the importance of the language-culture connection. This discussion of the failure of sufferers of autism to construct either a cultural role or robust cultural understanding raises another proposal that has become popular among some in the discussion of language evolution. This is what is referred to as niche construction theory, and is the idea that humans fuse part of the environment, say infancy and conversation, to create particular biocultural and psychological niches that enrich cognitive and linguistic development, such that people are able to construct larger and larger niches. Perhaps, one might reason, niche construction is the key to ASD. The child fails to construct the proper niche. In a sense, this is correct. But another special theory is unnecessary. ASD, so far as it relates to the connection between culture and the mind, is fully accounted for by what has already been proposed, without need for further theories. Niche theory is an elaborate mechanism to explain the development of the child and the species by focusing on the construction of relationships of individuals via conversational interaction. There is much to commend the work on niche construction, yet at the same time there are three problems that lead me to believe that it isn't very helpful to either the modeling of individual human language development or maturation, or to the understanding of human language evolution. First, much of niche construction is already accounted for by what psychologists refer to as attachment theory, which aims to determine if there are principles that govern the growth in relationship between infants and caregivers, and, if so, what those principles are, and whether these principles are the same across cultures. It appears that they might not be. The second reason one might not take niche theory to be an integral part of the story of language is that it is largely a metaphor for fairly well-understood phases of developmental psychology. And, finally, this is a theory that makes the wrong predictions about human language evolution, concluding that human language appeared only about 100,000 years ago, a conclusion claimed here to be incorrect. This matter arises in various aspects of the invention of language, such as in the fact that language is just good enough. Far from being a perfect biological system of any sort, language just gets by, often failing to communicate as well as one might imagine, its hearers employing general facts of the environmental context and world knowledge to interpret what is being said. And this echoes the strategy of aphasics and Homo erectus. Context and general knowledge are crucial to figure out the meanings of what people are hearing and in order to understand how to respond in the course of the conversation. For ASD sufferers, however, language is not even good enough. It is deficient, because for these people, their language is unable to link up with the social knowledge crucial to the major function of language, namely communication. A startling conclusion emerges from deficits affecting language. There are no language-only hereditary disorders. And the reason for that is predicted by the theory of language evolution here, namely that there could not be such a deficit because there is no language-specific part of the brain. Language is an invention. The brain is no more specialized for language than for tool-making, though over time both have affected the development of the brain in general ways that make it more supportive of these tasks. Language disorders are a window into the human brain and its preparedness for language. But language is more than the brain. It is a function of the entire body, including those components from the lungs to the mouth that make oral speech possible. Although we know that language and speech are distinct, and that there are various kinds of speech, visual speech, sign languages, and vocal speech, the primary form of speech in all the world's languages is oral. So the question we must answer, now that we understand the brain a bit better, is how did evolution prepare us to vocalize our languages? 8. Talking with tongues. If the play makes the public aware that there are such people as phoneticians, and that they are among the most important people in England at present, it will serve its turn. George Bernard Shaw, Preface to Pygmalion. In 1964, my 8th grade school marching band won a local competition in the Imperial Valley of Southern California. I played baritone horn and was an enthusiastic member. And I knew that, by winning this contest, we would now be able to go to the higher regional competition in Los Angeles, about 130 miles, 210 kilometers, to the northwest of our little town of Holtville, near the Mexican border. Our director wanted to expose the band to some higher culture while in the L.A. area, so he petitioned the school board to allow us to attend a showing of Mozart's opera, Don Giovanni. The school board said no, too risque for junior high schoolers. Instead, we were allowed to attend the band director's second choice, a showing at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood of My Fair Lady, starring Rex Harrison and Audrey Hepburn. The band instructor prepared us by talking about the play by George Bernard Shaw, the source for the movie. This film eventually played a role in my decision to become a linguist, as it revolved around the transformative power of human speech, told from the perspective of Henry Higgins and his reluctant pupil Eliza Doolittle. What is this thing called speech that all humans possess, that George Bernard Shaw believed to be the key to success in life? In The Kingdom of Speech, Tom Wolfe claims that speech is the most important invention in the history of the world. It not only enables us to speak to one another, but also immediately classifies by economic class, age group, and educational attainment. If erectus were around today, would people consider them brutish because of the way they spoke, even if one could so dress them as to pass them off as a peculiar-looking modern human? Although communication is ancient, human speech is evolutionarily recent. Cognitive scientist and phonetician Philip Lieberman claims that the speech apparatus of modern Homo sapiens is only about 50,000 years old, so recent that even earlier Homo sapiens could not speak as we do today. This is not to be confused, though, with the 50,000-year date proposed by other authors on the appearance of language. Speech followed language. Therefore, Lieberman's 50,000-year date would be, if correct, evidence against the idea that language proper appeared suddenly 50,000 years ago. If Erectus did indeed invent symbols and begin humanity's upward trek through the progression of signs to language, enhanced speech would have come later. It is expected that the first languages would have been inferior to our present languages. No invention begins at the top. All human inventions get better over time. And yet,